Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, it's been called the Great Arming. The dramatic growth in weapons permits across the U.S. Also, here in Iowa, there's been a steep increase in people acquiring weapons permits. It's a trend that some celebrate and others mourn. To be certain, it has very real consequences for both our state and the nation. 4 days this week here on River to River, with the exception of Wednesday, our politics day, we'll be exploring gun laws and gun culture. So this is an opportunity for you, River to River listeners, to tell us about your relationship with guns by sending an email to us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Some questions to think about to prompt you with an email to us. Perhaps you have a particularly telling experience involving a gun to recount. Or do you believe more guns lead to a safer or a more dangerous society? Where do you come down on that question? What are your thoughts on how the politics of guns have changed over the years to where they are today? Once again, share your thoughts, your experiences. All this week, we're exploring guns and gun culture. Share your thoughts. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Tomorrow on the program, we'll be examining the implications of the new Stand Your Ground laws here in the state by taking you to a permit to carry class that producer Emily Woodbury and I attended recently in Hiawatha. Interestingly, it was a class only for women. 13 Iowa women were there to get training on how, where, and when to use a weapon. Interestingly also, about half of them had never shot a gun in their life. Everyday Iowa women who now feel the need to carry a weapon. That's tomorrow on the program. Today, though, we focus on the medical and public health side of being shot, the injuries and deaths resulting from gun violence. There are some 32,000 deaths a year from guns in the U.S. In Iowa, over 200 gun deaths annually, according to CDC statistics. In the last few years, parts of Iowa have seen spikes in gun violence and shootings. For instance, in Des Moines, in Cedar Rapids, we reported them here on Iowa Public Radio. Nationally and here in Iowa, more people between the ages of 15 and 24 are shot than any other age group. Let's get into that a little bit more when we talk with our public health expert. Before that, let's find out, to start off, what it's like to be shot. And joining us to do that, Pastor Willie Campbell of Waterloo. He's pastor at Cathedral of Faith in Waterloo. That's a Southern Baptist-affiliated church. Pastor Campbell, welcome to our program.
Well, good morning, and I thank you for this opportunity to share the story with the listening audience.
We thank you for being on to share it. This goes quite a while back. I understand you were a boy of 8 years old in 1970. Tell us, how did it happen?
Well, the newspaper said it was about 1972 or 3, and then they had me at 10 years old in the paper.
All right.
But the actual accident did occur. One day, a friend of mine and I were walking home from school, probably third grade, and we decided to stop. We lived in a suburb of Waterloo called City View. And it's you know, out for extension, like heading to Tyson area, the manufacturing plant. But we stopped by his house, and which we lived about a block from each other. He lived on the corner end, and I lived in the middle of the block. And we stopped by his house and started playing with his. He had a BB gun. His brother had a BB gun. And he started to shoot his brother's BB gun, and I got his BB gun. And so we were shooting, like, pictures off the wall because wasn't nobody home but me and him.
Shooting pictures off the wall with a BB gun, but then a proper gun, a rifle, came into the picture. How did that happen?
Okay, so then we proceeded, he proceeded, from downstairs to upstairs, and I followed him. to his parents' bedroom. And when I got to the entryway of the door, he was standing in the entryway of his parents' closet, which was about 25 feet, maybe 15, 20 feet from where I was. He came out with the 30-30 Winchester deer rifle with the hollow point. And apparently it was loaded, which we neither one of us knew. But it went off and struck me in my right, left arm, right above my fist is where the bullet entered. And then it exploded on the outside, inside of my arm. But the fragments continued to travel to my abdomen area. And I still suffer from some complications from that.
And to be clear, those not familiar with this type of round, it's a hollow point, when it impacts it, it sort of disperses and to cause maximum injury in this case to the deer, but to you in this case. And so fragments of this bullet were not just in your arm, but other parts of your body.
Yeah, what happened, my arm saved my life. Because as that type of bullet hit a deer, it's designed to explode from the inside out. And it takes all your organs out.
Mm-hmm. What did you do after immediately being shot? What did you and your friends do?
Well, I proceeded to grab my arm and feel the pain burning. And I had a coat on, too, but it was kind of like a fall. But he ran out the house screaming, he had shot Willie. And down to the neighborhood, I don't know where he went. I probably didn't see him again until, I don't know, 5-6 months after I was totally released from the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, he just kind of lost it. And I went. So we were upstairs, so I made it down the stairs by myself and about a block and a half from his house. Streets, getting to my house to try and get some help. And so when I finally made it to my house, my mother, out there in the living room, is in her basement. So when you come in the stairs, I'm in the doorway, you come up the stairs.
We're having a hard time hearing you on your cell phone, Pastor Campbell. Let's keep trying for a little bit.
I told you that I had a
Okay, perhaps we can come back to the pastor in just a moment. Let me introduce our two surgeons on this hour. Dr. Denville Myrie is with us. He's a trauma surgeon at Mercy Medical Center in Des Moines. Dr. Myrie, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ben. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure being here.
Dr. Pat McGonigal is with us, a clinical assistant professor of surgery at the University of Iowa in our Iowa City studio. Dr. McGonigal, welcome.
Thank you, Ben. It's a pleasure to be here.
We hope to get back to Willie Campbell in just a moment to hear the rest of his story. The phone line kind of broke up there, as you heard. But let me start with you, Dr. Myrie. Based on what you heard there, Willie's story of his gunshot wound, granted in the 1970s, how does that compare with what you commonly deal with when you have gunshot wounds to deal with?
Well, from what I could detect from the conversation with the pastor, it appears that he had a gunshot wound to his upper extremity, which, in the whole scheme of things, that seems like obviously a non-fatal injury if it had hit a major vessel, like the brachial artery or axillary artery. Obviously, that could have led to a fatality. What we see today with the gun violence, and to me, I think it has become an epidemic right now. And I think we need to have the conversation about gun violence as a disease and reaching the point of an epidemic. We have seen an explosion in the Des Moines area in regards to gun violence. I actually trained in New York and did some years as an attending in New York. and back in the 90s, and there was a significant amount of gun violence. Moving here to Iowa, I never imagined that we'd be at the point where we are today. And now you can see from most of the major cities in America, it has become an epidemic.
Mm-hmm. Can you put some quantify that a little bit for us when you say it's an explosion? How has the explosion happened over the past few years?
Well, say go back to 5 years ago, my personal experience at Mercy, we had zero gun violence related deaths. And fast forward to 2016, we had 132 gun-related injuries, 13 fatalities. Granted, six of those fatalities were murders or homicide, and the other were self-inflicted or suicide. And this year, we have six fatalities, six homicide so far, and another two self-inflicted fatalities. So going from 5 years ago, there was zero to a year ago, there was 13. Obviously, something has happened in our communities.
What can you tell about the type of gunshot wounds that you treat to indicate what has happened? What is your answer to that question as a trauma surgeon?
The most of the injuries that we see, the pedestrian type of gun violence, are mostly from handguns, semi-automatic, a particular favorite of a lot of street violence is 9mm. And when you see a bullet, granted, is a projectile, is a missile, leaving the muzzle of a gun at over 1,200 feet per second, when that hit the body, it creates devastating injury. Obviously, the closer range could create more damage than if you're far away. But we see, for example, 2 weeks ago, I had a patient that came in. He was a casualty of a drive-by shooting. He was shot once in the chest and once in the lower extremity. He was unresponsive at the scene and was brought in by first responders in traumatic arrest. I mean, pretty much in extremis, at the brink of death. So with a situation like that, first thing we do, we're taught as trauma surgeons, you go through ABCs. First, you make sure the airways is patent. If it's not, you have to intervene and secure an airway and make sure the patient is breathing and the circulation is intact, meaning it has a blood pressure and a pulse. And then you look through the disabilities and you go through ABCs like in that format. However, this gentleman was, he had gunshot wound went through the heart, so he essentially is sanguinate in the scene. So by the time he got to us, unfortunately, it was too late. But you never know, so we did everything. We put chest tubes to relieve any pneumothorax or air inside the chest cavity that could collapse his lung or remove excess blood in his chest cavity. We did what is called an emergency department thoracotomy, which is almost last ditch effort to try to revive a penetrating trauma patient once they present to your emergency department, meaning that there is no other alternative. Mm-hmm. And that's doing that, meaning you open the chest in the emergency department because you don't have time to take the patient to the operating room. And we try to do internal cardiac massage. Instead of doing CPR chest compression on the outside, you actually open the chest, expose the heart from the sac, use your hands and actually squeeze the heart to create artificially pumping the heart to circulate the blood. Unfortunately, that young man, he was 23 years old, otherwise healthy, and he didn't make it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, 2 years ago, my personal experience, I had a 15-year-old, similar incident.
This is here in Des Moines?
Right here in Des Moines. And again, we did everything possible, and his injuries were so severe, we were able to revive him and get him to the operating room. But again, once you reach that point, we call it point of no return, the lethal triad, which means the patient is has lost significant amount of blood, they're cold, they're coagulopathic, and they're severely acidotic. It's hard to revive a patient once they reach to that stage.
Dr. Danville Myrie is with us, for listeners who've just joined us, a trauma surgeon at Mercy Medical Center in Des Moines, talking about the treatment of gunshot wounds, the dramatic uptick, as he outlined just a few moments ago, from just in the last 5 years, and the number of gunshots they are dealing with there. This is the busiest emergency room in the state of Iowa, I believe, Dr. Myrie. And you mentioned New York, but I understand you also did a fellowship in Baltimore. It's a city that we very much associate with gun violence. Are you seeing Des Moines becoming more like Baltimore, unfortunately, in this way?
Unfortunately, the answer is yes. I was in Baltimore in 2010, 2011, when I did a trauma fellowship. And a Chuck Trauma, and it's one of the busiest freestanding trauma hospital in the country. And it was a daily occurrence to see 2, 3, 4 gunshot wound victims that presents every day. And I've been in communication with my colleagues back in Baltimore, and they're seeing a similar explosion of gun violence. I mean, Baltimore was already a city that had a significant amount of gun violence, but there has been an uptick again this year and over the past 2 years. And I'm not sure exactly what the cause is, but I can tell you that for those who propose increasing the number of guns on our street as an answer, I mean, that's a proposition that is it's loaded with fallacy, with no basis in reality. I mean, if we should look at other countries with, just look at the United States, for example. I mean, it's estimated that there are over 300 million guns in circulation. That's one gun for every man, woman, and child in this country, approximately. And you look at other countries like, say, Germany, for example. The risk of dying from a gunshot wound in Germany is almost the same as dying in the United States of getting hit in the head from a falling object. You know, so we don't have to go far to compare country with rational gun safety laws with those with irrational gun safety laws. I think in the United States, we have very irrational gun safety laws. There is no gun safety laws, in fact. And I think we, as a society, need to start thinking about these things. We spend over $1 trillion a year in protecting our citizens from terrorist attack. And when you look at, I mean, how many people actually die from terrorism? And we look at, for example, domestic terrorism or mass shooting, which would be defined as single incidents of shooting that killed or injured more than 4 people. In 2015, it's estimated that there was about 372 mass shootings in the United States that account for about 475 deaths, okay? And from the 9/11, when in 2001, when there were 2,996 deaths from that incident, over that 15-year period, over 500,000 Americans have lost their lives from gun violence, from the simple firearm gun violence. And our legislatures are doing nothing about it. In fact, they're making the laws even more lenient for people to own guns.
Let's talk about that a little bit later in the hour. Dr. Danville Myrie is with us, a trauma surgeon at Mercy Medical Center in Des Moines. I wanted to get back before we say goodbye to Pastor Willie Campbell, who was relaying, unfortunately, on a telephone line that didn't work very well. Let's get back to him before the break. Pastor Campbell, are you with us there?
I'm trying to be.
Oh, it sounds much better now. Let's fast forward a little bit. You had a long recovery, didn't you? Quickly, before our break, tell us. Your recovery took how long?
My recovery took at least from 6 months to a year, totally.
Mm-hmm. After being shot unintentionally by a friend with a Winchester deer rifle, what do you remember most about that incident? Does trauma still affect you from that shooting?
Oh yeah, yeah. Guns is. I teach kids now not to play with guns, and parents not to leave guns where kids can get them. And the most thing I remember about it is the burning, the trauma of being in the hospital for 6 months, of going through many, many skin grafts and surgeries. And I have the wounds and the scars to remind me.
Mm-hmm.
It's not only in my head, but I have visuals.
Pastor Campbell, you're at Cathedral of Faith, a house of worship in Waterloo. Do you talk about guns with your congregation?
I actually did a segment on guns with KWWL when they were doing a series of kids and guns. And I did a live interview with KWWL and the congregation.
Mm.
And they know my story. You know, they know I'm a miracle.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Pastor Campbell. Your phone line is breaking up again. We're going to have to leave it there. So sorry. Apologies for that. Let's go to our other surgeon here, Dr. Pat McGonigal in our Iowa City studio. You heard what Dr. Myrie was saying there in Des Moines. Now, I understand you've been at the University of Iowa how long? Not very long.
Just over a year now.
Just over a year now. Can you echo what Dr. Myrie calls an explosion in gun violence wounds that you are treating as well?
Absolutely, Ben. Yep. So we've seen, and just from historical times to now, we have seen an increase, not as dramatic as in Des Moines in the Iowa City area, but we do have a very large referral base covering a lot of the rural counties in the area. So we do have some violent gunshot wounds coming in our way, but the majority of the gunshot wounds that come to us at the University of Iowa are suicides. That makes up the vast majority of the folks that are coming to us with gunshot wounds, although we are seeing a uptick in the number of assaults that come in our way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I don't know if you have rough statistics on that.
I don't have it in front of me, no, sir.
Uh-huh. So how often would you say in a week or a month, if you want to put it the way Dr. McGonigal, how often do you treat a gunshot wound?
Somewhere around once or twice a week we'll have a gunshot wound. We also have stabbings and things like that that come in as well with slightly higher frequency, but we do see quite a few gunshot wounds.
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment. We're going to continue. This is the first part of our series, look at guns and gun culture in the nation and in our state of Iowa. The dramatic growth in weapons permits across the U.S., also the steep increase in weapons permits here in Iowa. We're trying to ferret out some of the consequences of this increase. If you'd like to join us, join our conversation with your email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back with our two trauma surgeons, as well as the public health expert, Corinne Peek Asa. That's when we come back. You can share your relationship with guns. Perhaps it's an experience that you've had. Do guns, in your mind, lead to a safer or a more dangerous society? 1-866-780-9100 or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with more in just a moment here on River to River. Back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. Doing something different this week. We're having a series, four of the five shows this week over the noon hour here on River to River. We're looking at guns and gun culture. And with the exception of Wednesday, that's what we'll be doing, different facets. Tomorrow on the program, we'll be examining the implications of the new Stand Your Ground laws here in the state. We'll be taking you to a permit to carry class that producer Emily Woodbury and I attended in Hiawatha. Interestingly, a class only for women, 13 women we were with in a classroom on a shooting range in simulations. You'll hear it tomorrow. About half of them had never shot a gun in their life. These are everyday Iowa women, your neighbors perhaps, who now feel the need to carry a weapon and feel the need to get the training to do that. We'll focus on that tomorrow. Today, the medical and public health aspects of being shot. There are some 32,000 deaths a year from guns in the U.S. That varies, of course, year to year. In Iowa, over 200 every year. And as we've been talking with two trauma surgeons this first half hour, dramatic uptick in the number of gun violence injuries, deaths they're dealing with. Dr. Denville Myrie is with us, a trauma surgeon at Mercy Medical Center in Des Moines. It's the busiest emergency room in our state. Also with us, Dr. Pat McGonigal, clinical assistant professor of surgery at the University of Iowa. Going back to our initial understanding Dr. McGonigal, for you of how bullets injure and kill us. Tell us about the damage a bullet can do to a body when you are dealing with someone with a gunshot wound. What are you looking at? What factors are there? The type of bullet, where it goes through the body. Walk us through some of the factors there that you're looking at as a trauma surgeon.
Absolutely. So the damage a bullet can do largely depends upon several factors, which would include the size or caliber of the bullet, if it's actually a bullet, whether the tip of the bullet is hollow point, and how much gunpowder is used to propel the bullet. So rifled bullets, hunting rifles, things like that, tend to have a lot more gunpowder to them, so they reach a lot higher velocity and can pass through tissue a lot faster.
And these hollow point bullets, upon impact, they do what?
They mushroom. So they deform in such a way that they cause a larger amount of damage than just the profile of the bullet would cause on its own.
Mm-hmm.
So that can cause some devastating results.
Mm-hmm.
The other types of firearms, you know, have some lower velocity things such as shotguns. Those can either be fired in terms of slugs, which are used a lot of times for hunting. Those are large lead bullets that also cause a significant amount of damage. And also shot, which is multiple small pellets, or depending on what type of shot you're using, larger pellets that can then cause a wider spread injury.
Mm-hmm.
The other sort of things that can cause differences would be the length of the barrel. So when you have a shotgun that's been sawn off, as we hear of on the news sometimes, that's a barrel that's been cut short, which then causes the particles of the bullet to spread out larger and cause damage over a larger area.
Mm-hmm.
So when I see a patient come in, one of the keys to being an effective trauma surgeon is understanding the anatomy of the area that's injured, and also understanding that a bullet does not necessarily take a straight line course through things.
How does that happen? It can ricochet in the body?
It can, yes. Yeah. So if it hits a bone, it can definitely change its course, or hits other solid organs, it can change its course through tissues. We sometimes can see these courses with CT scans and things like that, but more often than not, we just have to presume that many things between the two bullet holes, if there are in fact two bullet holes, could have been injured. So,
mm-hmm. Back to you, Dr. Myrie. Typically, the Hollywood depiction is that once you're shot, unless you're shot in the heart or vital organ in the head or something like that, the key is to get the bullet out, and you know, John Wayne is there to give you a jug of whiskey to deal with the pain. I'm making a little fun of a very serious subject here, but is really getting the bullet out the main focus as a trauma surgeon?
Absolutely not. That's often a misconception to the public. That's oftentimes the last thing that a trauma surgeon would be concerned about is retrieval of the bullet. As our other guest states, once the bullet hit the body, it can change direction, and anything in its path is a target. And we oftentimes, most of the death from gunshot wound is actually the result of hemorrhage. If the bullet hits a major vessel, you will exsanguinate. The patient will exsanguinate, and the key to
bleed to death.
Exactly, and the key to taking care of this patient is to get in as fast as possible to control that hemorrhage. So a bullet, retrieving the bullet, oftentimes if you're able to just take the bullet out, it's most likely just a soft tissue injury and doesn't hit any vital organs. But majority of the time, once the bullet hit the body, it is going to create devastating injury. It could injure your liver, your spleen, your intestines. You have a lot of large vessels in your abdominal cavity, such as the aorta, vena cava. If you hit your extremity, you could hit major vessels. And in fact, there is a lot of lesson that we have learned from, for example, the Boston bombing and the Orlando shooting. And the Sandy Hook is, there's been a big campaign in the trauma community regarding to what is referred to as Stop the Bleeding campaign. And what was learned from those incidents is that people actually bled out while they were waiting for first responders because it was an active shooter situation. So the trauma community now has been employing or implementing this Stop the Bleed campaign to empower lay people how to temporize the situation to apply direct pressure to a bleeding patient or apply a tourniquet in an appropriate situation until the first responder arrive, because that's how people die. They die majority of the time from hemorrhaging to death before they can get to a medical facility.
Dr. Denville Myrie is with us, a trauma surgeon, as well as Dr. Pat McGonigal, a clinical assistant professor of surgery at the University of Iowa. Both have dealt with many, many gunshot wounds in their careers and are commenting to us today about treating gunshot wounds as we've seen a traumatic uptick. Dr. Myrie, I have to go back to you for the new listeners this half hour. 5 years ago, no gunshot wounds you were treating there in at the Mercy Medical Center, and how many now?
Right. 5 years ago, we had no gunshot-related deaths. There were some incidents of unintentional injuries, but no deaths. Today, last year, 2016, we had 13 gun-related fatalities. And these are just the ones that actually show up to our emergency department for treatment. We're not even considering those that actually died at the scene or go to other local hospitals. This is just our Mercy experience. And so far this year, we have seen 8 deaths so far from gun violence. You mentioned a 32,000 a year death. I mean, that's a very staggering number. And that roughly equates about 93 people die every day from gun violence.
I heard it expressed once, every 3 days, that would be every 2 or 3 days, a jumbo jet going down with no survivors.
Precisely.
Mm-hmm. Let me introduce another person to our conversation before the hour gets away from us, Dr. Myrie and Dr. McGonigal. Corinne Peek-Asa has been on our program as before, a great resource for us, professor and associate dean of research at the College of Public Health at the University of Iowa. Corinne, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much.
You've been conducting a new study that you have out related to gun violence. Tell us, what did you look at?
Well, we looked nationally, so we're jumping from the individual patient to what's happening in the population level in the total U.S. And we looked at probably the best source of data on hospitalizations. And we were interested in doing this, looking at the cost of what are the direct dollars that we're paying for patients treated in the hospital for firearm injuries. We were interested in doing this because there have been several studies that looked at the overall burden of firearm injuries, including deaths, including the injuries, but also including costs of what is a premature death. So what does it cost us to be differentially losing people at a young age, which is absolutely the profile of a firearm death? What is the cost of lost work time? What is the cost of pain and suffering? What is the judicial and correctional side? So those, of course, show billions of dollars of costs every year. With all of the attention on our healthcare system and its costs and who is insured and who's not, we were interested in looking specifically at hospitalization costs. So we tallied all of the hospitalizations in the U.S. Through this sample called the National Inpatient Sample. And we were mostly interested in coming up with data that would help hospitals predict what they might see. So rather than adding up all of the costs, we did a predictive model to say, controlling for hospital size, type, and patient characteristics, what is the predicted admission cost? And it was $622 million on average every year between the 10 years we looked at, which was 2003 to 2013. But we were also interested in looking at some characteristics like assault versus self-harm and then the type of weapon. But most particularly the payer. And so what we found is that a quarter of firearm injury hospitalizations were among people who had no insurance, and another 30-35% were among patients who had Medicaid. So that means that more than 60% of the costs that are paid to care for firearm injury victims is in the public sphere. So we think this is important you know, to show that this really is a public burden, and it's a cost that we all bear in through the government sources.
We've heard a lot about the opioid epidemic here in the United States, as we should hear about it. It is an epidemic. We've done programs on that. But I'm just trying to think about the ways in which what we're describing here, our surgeons have described, your statistics describe, over 30,000 deaths a year, gun-related deaths here. This is an epidemic. It seems to be treated much differently.
Well, you know, being an epidemiologist, I would call the opioid epidemic rightly so because it's more than what we expect. I would say it's worse with firearm injuries because it's endemic. We have gotten so used to seeing so many deaths, and we're alarmed now because it's gone up. But for example, in Iowa, the firearm death rate has increased about on average 15% a year from 2005 to 2014, and maybe some acceleration after that. But this is not a new problem. So to us, it's endemic.
Right. Can we tie that increase that you just cited there to changes? Why is it happening?
As a researcher, I can say we don't really know. And one thing that is strikingly different about firearm injuries as a health outcome is that we aren't doing research. If we are interested in car crashes, in the opioid epidemic, there are huge increases in the amount of research going into figuring out what to do. And we don't see that in firearm injuries. In fact, there's legislated prohibitions on doing certain types of
so what is it? This is a surprise. And Dr. Myrie, I'll let you get in here in just a moment, but I wanted to have Corinne finish up here because this is an important point. As a public health expert, we research all kinds of things that injure us as a society, cause deaths and injury. But gun-related deaths are set aside because of the political controversy?
Well, I'll just bring up two interesting pieces of legislation that affect what we know about firearm deaths. One is a very specific ban on funds to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on doing anything related to what might be interpreted as gun safety advocacy. So it's not exactly a research inclusion, but it's definitely interpreted that way. Yet another really interesting legislative facet is there's language that very specifically precludes the firearm from being considered a consumer product. So, for example, the Consumer Product Safety Commission has a very wonderful data collection system that looks at products and how those products might injure us. So childhood toys all the way to motor vehicles. They are not allowed to collect consumer injury data on firearms. So there are a number of different ways.
Can we collect them on knives, but not firearms?
Yep.
Okay, everything but firearms. Dr. Myrie, you wanted to jump in there.
Yeah, I mean, I just think it's just mind-boggling in our society that our lawmakers have put in restriction and doing research that can actually save lives. I mean, as our previous guest has stated, there's laws in the books that prohibit government funding to doing sensible research on gun violence and gun deaths. And how are we going to correct the problem if we can't study it and find out what the root cause is?
Mm-hmm. Okay, jump in here, Dr. McGonigal.
So there's a recent study that was published by one of the trauma groups that I'm a member of, the Eastern Association for the Surgery of Trauma, that created guidelines and looked at the data on gun laws and what the effects are on gun violence. And looking at this collection of multiple different studies that they analyzed, they specifically found that restrictive licensing policies for guns decreased rates of gun violence, that in itself. And another issue that oftentimes comes up is concealed carry laws. Are they in fact a way to prevent further gun violence by having people armed in order to deal with an armed assailant? And they did not, in fact, in this study indicate that decreased gun violence at all. It also, in fact, in certain studies showed increased rates of gun violence with concealed carry laws alone as a method of decreasing gun violence.
Finishing up this hour talking about gun and gun culture, the first in our series this week, we'd like to have you join us. Also, as this hour ends, I remind you that you can share your perhaps a telling experience that involved a gun 1-866-780-9100. Thursday's program will be devoted to all about the politics of guns in this country. Let's try to get a caller in before we have to end this hour. So much to talk about. Nate, please be brief. Thank you for calling in at the end of our program today.
Yeah, I was just curious if there's any statistics on the death rate in their emergency rooms and the death rate in Iowa, if there are statistics on whether it was a self-defense situation or just a criminal act. If it was self-defense, maybe the situation of defending oneself actually saved more lives than the one life that was taken. Obviously, with more guns out in the public with concealed carry and stand your ground, there might be more deaths related to that, but I was curious if the Self-Defense Act and the lives saved in those acts are making a difference in statistics.
Great question, Nate in Iowa City. Let's turn, first of all, to our public health expert, Corinne Peek-Asa. What can you tell Nate and the rest of us?
Well, I can say that the few studies that have been done on state policy have shown that more protective, restrictive laws do tend to be associated with lower gun death rates. To your specific question, the data is really hard to find. So one of the problems is that we have medical data that talks a lot about the victim. We have law enforcement and corrections data that talks a lot about the perpetrator, but we have very little data that talks about the context between the perpetrator and the victim. I will say there's one effort to overcome that, and Iowa is part of it. There is a national program called the National Violent Death Review System, and it's an attempt to get comprehensive data about firearm and all types of violent deaths, not just those caused by a firearm. And Iowa is has been granted funds to participate in this surveillance system, and that is the Iowa Iowa Violent Death Reporting System, run through the Iowa Department of Public Health. And hopefully, as we have better data, we will be able to make more evidence-based choices about what we do. I will say, in our national study, one of the biggest challenges we had is that most of the time in the medical data, we don't even know generally what type of weapon it was. So 60% of the time, we couldn't tell if it was a rifle, an assault rifle, a shotgun, or a handgun. So certainly investing in better data is something that can help us make better decisions.
Mm-hmm. As we end this hour, we have about 4 minutes left. Let's cast our eyes to the future and ask Dr. Myrie what you say in a minute or two, given that 300 million guns are not going to disappear from the U.S. What can be done to make gun violence less of a problem, less of a fatal problem for families out there?
Well, I think there's a few things I think that could be done to help stem this this epidemic. I think
we only have a couple minutes left, and I want to get the others in there. So sorry, right. Please.
So
be brief.
I think there should be government-funded research. I think our legislature need to enact more rational gun safety legislation, and I think we also need to start doing some early elementary and preschool education on gun violence and the impact on our society. And also to have more community outreach to intervene and to prevent what a lot of people are considering retribution killing. And to teach young people, particularly in underserved communities, that their lives do matter and that lives is worth protecting.
I'm going to turn to Dr. McGonigal. I'm sorry to cut you short, but our hour is merciless that way. Dr. McGonigal, your final thoughts as we end this hour?
I agree with many of Dr. Myrie's points here, and I think gun safety education, as well as, you know, encouraging people to keep guns locked in their houses and things like that, is important. And also encouraging folks to learn how to manage hemorrhage. Like as Dr. Myrie had mentioned before, the Stop the Bleed campaign is a hot topic right now, and it's something we are hoping to roll out throughout the state, and at least training first responders and then your average citizen how to control bleeding. And if you have any further interest in this, any of the listeners can go to bleedingcontrol.org for more information on that.
Okay, 30 seconds for you, Corinne Peek-Asa.
30 seconds. I would say we need a comprehensive evidence-based approach, just like how we reduced smoking, just like how we reduced firearm or motor vehicle injuries. So we need the evidence to help inform our decisions.
And for that, we need the funding to conduct the research to do this. And so legislatures in states and the federal legislature would have to be are called upon, in your opinion?
Absolutely.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
Very good. Thank you very much for joining us. Dr. Denville Myrie, Corinne Peek-Asa, and Dr. Pat McGonigal, thank you very much.
The
hour went very quickly. So much to talk about. Thank you for coming into our studios today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben.
Continuing our gun series, Gun Culture, this week, tomorrow, we'll take you to a permit to carry class that I attended recently in Hiawatha. Hope you'll tune in for that. 13 Iowa women there training how, where, and when to use a weapon. That's tomorrow on this program. Please do tell us if you have a particularly telling experience involving a gun to recount. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton with help from Robbie Broad. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.